That's Freedom Dance Jazz by Eddie Harris. It's from his 1965 album, The In Sound. Miles Davis would record this very tune 2 years later. Eddie Harris, you should know, introduced the concept and the reality of the electrified saxophone. And you heard him there on sax. Ray Codrington on trumpet, Cedar Walton on piano, Ron Carter on bass, and Billy Higgins on drums. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It's Thursday, February the 19th, and a joy to be back with you again today. And I hope this program would be as enjoying, as wonderful for you as I anticipate it will be for me. And that's because we have as our guest an elder. Retirement has not slowed her down. She is Vernelia Randall. And quite to the contrary, retirement has given her a second wind. The former University of Dayton School of Law professor has doubled down on her activist work, speaking truth to power, as she says on her website, and working continuously at changing the world through law, love, and activism. Professor Randall writes and lectures extensively on race, on women's issues, on health care, and on the law. And she's with us to engage in a wide-ranging discussion about what is justice in America today. She is the co-founder of Racial Justice Now, based in Dayton. It's a grassroots organization of educators, parents, clergy, and community activists dedicated to fighting institutional and systemic racism and holding people in power accountable. Apart from her academic accomplishments in law, Professor Randall also has been and still is a registered nurse, has had an impressive career in public health. She was, in fact, the administrator of a statewide public health program in Alaska. She is the author of a very, very important book. I hope you would get it. It's titled Dying While Black. It is an in-depth look at race-based disparities in U.S. healthcare. And she's so much more than I've been able to say in this short introduction, as you will find out very shortly. But a very warm welcome to you, Elder Randall. Professor Emerita.
Thank you. I so appreciate being invited.
Thank you so much. Well, let's start with this question of being an elder. What does it mean to you, and how did you get that promotion?
I self-promoted. it's a really interesting story because I self-promoted myself. I had this idea about eldership. I believe, and I'm so happy about the young people that are out there. And I believe that part of getting to a certain age, I'm nearly 70, is you need to step back and support the younger people who are doing the work. Your role changes or should change. And unfortunately, and I think this is one of the problems, is the generation, there's a whole generation of people my age who will not step back. And I think if you were to talk to the young people in my community, they would tell you how supportive I am of them, but that I let them be at the forefront, that I don't try to lead things here as much as I try to support them in doing it. And I think what has happened, and I think elders have traditionally had that role, but that because of so many factors, we have lost the concept of elders in our community. And I think people are wanting to bring it back. To that end, I'm a part of a group who started the Dayton Africana Elders Council. And it's a group of people over 55 who are committed to the Africana community and who is committed to non-Western ideas of thinking, working, and getting things done, and to supporting our younger people in their activism and in their development.
Well, in about 20 years or so, I may qualify on the basis of age. I don't know. But I wanted to ask about what you just said. When you say that you're committed to a non-Western way of doing things, what is the reason for that?
Well, because the Western way is housed in capitalism, and is housed in individualism, and so that almost everything, almost every organization, almost every group, whether it's a company or not, so like nonprofits, even groups and organizations, operate in that capitalist, individualist model. We don't know what those of us who are part of Africana Council are trying to find another way for our community to operate, another economic model, a model based on this. Our council is based on the seven principles of Kwanzaa. And so we want to have a model that is cooperative economics. When people say to us, we need more entrepreneurs, I'm like, only. We more need more entrepreneurs only if they're going to give up the capitalist model of doing things. If what you're saying is you want more black capitalists, then I cannot support that. We need a more socialist society, a society that believes that it has a responsibility to everyone and to the health and welfare and well-being of everyone, and not do, you know, in our society, we are so worried about the undeserving poor. We're so worried that we're going to do for something for someone who doesn't deserve it, that we're willing to let suffer everyone who does deserve it just so that we can make sure that we aren't helping someone who doesn't deserve it. And I think that's a Western model. I think that I don't want to over stereotype, because I think Africa is a continent, not a country, and there are about 52, 57 countries in Africa, and very many more cultures and groups. But in many of the groups, they reject that model or historically reject that model until they had it imposed upon them. So we're searching. We don't have the exact model, except that we know what we don't want to be.
Well, this brings me to the question, and it's really in your answer. You said that it is not enough at all to have a black face adopting a wrong model. In your view, is that what has happened a lot in the experience, the African-American experience, that we've had the black faces executing the wrong models?
No, I think that's exactly right. And I believe what happened coming out of, I think that before the 60s, before the late 60s, early 70s, black faces who succeed, and we had people who succeeded all of the time, all of the time. There's always been very successful African descendants, but they were in the same boat with the less successful. That is, their success was always handicapped by their skin color, that they, there was things they couldn't do, places they couldn't go, that even if they were acceptable entertainment, they, entertainer, they couldn't go into, they couldn't sleep in hotels, even if they were, world-renowned doctors, hospitals would turn them away when they were sick. So there was a self-interest in making sure that the whole community got out of that. I was a beneficiary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and direct beneficiary. Everything that happened to me in my life would not have happened except for the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But what happened to many people, I believe, is they begin to believe the American meritocracy stuff that is said. So that's a whole nother part of the Western model, that people get stuff because they deserve it, and people who aren't getting it is because they have some flaw that makes them undeserving. And so a large group of African descendants who benefited from the Civil Rights Act of 1964 begin to believe in that model. And at the same time, our community still suffering from the lack of power, the lack of resources, the lack of people who look like us in places that have power, begin to celebrate just the getting of a person in power, and not really wanting to criticize them for the fact that they fail us as a community. It happened over and over again that people would get elected and then fail us as a community. But what has become important is having the faith in those positions for many people in our community, because we worked, because we don't realize how underrepresented, we're a small part of this society, 13%. We're surrounded all our lives by people who don't look like us, and the lack and the struggle that we undergo means that when we see someone else succeed, we are happy for them, and that's fine. But we should not support them unless they support the community.
How does this relate to your own profession of law?
Well, part of the thing that happens, it's an interesting, the law is about maintaining the status quo. The whole legal education is about making sure people are going to help maintain the status quo. Lawyers are the gatekeepers. I often say, if you want to make change in society, you have to have money or you have to have law. And so the people with money get lawyers to be the gatekeeper, because we think of ourselves, and I say we, meaning the universal we, the whole United States, we say all the time that we are a nation of law. We make decisions not based on self-help, but based on the rule of law. So when you have a society that says that you're based on the rule of law, you've got to make sure that the people who are in that profession are not going to be quick to change the law that you worked so hard to get down. And so the whole system, the educational system, the legal system after you get out, all of is designed to make it very difficult to bring about systemic changes in society through the law. And one other thing I'll say before I let you talk, is the other thing in this society that people have to realize that in our society, anything that is not illegal is legal, because that's the way we operate. If there's not a law that makes it illegal, then it's legal. So discrimination based on race is legal in our society as long as you don't intend it. And all you have to do is say, well, intent wasn't my, you know, yes, I knew it was having a disparate impact on blacks, but that wasn't my intent. The law says, yeah, that's okay. You can do that.
In fact, that is at the root of that major U.S. Supreme Court decision that is anticipated on housing, essentially, as long as the government can prove and developers can prove they didn't intend to segregate communities, they cannot be held liable for it.
And I think people are going to be surprised, but they shouldn't be, because this change has been going on for 30 years, at least 30 years. And under every administration, every single administration, the Title VI of the Civil Rights Act, which specifically forbids discrimination based on race, the court has consistently interpreted that as meaning intent. Now, the administrative agencies have said, well, you can also sue on disparate impact. You know, if you, maybe you can't prove that someone intentionally discriminated against you, but if you can prove that the person undertook an act that had a disparate impact, you can sue. About 15 years ago, the court decided to make it where you cannot sue on that, that all you can do is complain to an agency, and nobody knows it. I get so upset when people say, oh, you can't discriminate in this country. And the answer is, yes, you can. You can discriminate based on race. As long as it's not intentional, you can discriminate. And that's been going on for years. And no administration, Clinton, Bush, the Bushes, Obama has been willing to push Congress to correct it, because Congress could fix it. That's the other thing people think. Everybody acts, Congress acts as if when the Supreme Court says something is illegal, that there's nothing they can do about it. But all the Supreme Court says is the way you worded this particular law, go back, reword it, and come back. So the thing on intentional discrimination based on race, the Supreme Court basically said since the law doesn't say that you can sue on disparate impact, and since we have said you have to have intent, we recognize that the administrative agency can do something different, but we're not going to let you sue on that. Well, the legislature could have just gone and said, okay, we are making a law that says you cannot discriminate based on disparate impact. And they never did that, and they refused to fix it. And it didn't matter who was in power. In fact, I lobbied very hard to try to get Obama to fix it in the health care law, and they refused. So
I want to stay on this question of the law and African Americans in the law as professionals for a minute, because we have seen in recent months a veritable tidal wave of police-involved killings and use of excessive force. And we have seen African American lawyers in the fray representing either the aggrieved people who have lost people to this violence, this kind of violence, and also people who have survived it. But there is a disturbing thing, and we've talked about it quite a bit on this program, that there seems to be the approach, and it seems to be a uniform approach, and I wondered whether you have detected it as well, that the immediate concern is for settlements rather than litigating for justice. Have you detected that schism in this particular movement?
Yes, I actually have, and got quite frustrated here. We have a case here, John Crawford, where John Crawford and the attorneys are suing everybody and setting up the case, I think, because they're also suing
Walmart.
But
you should just to let you identify John Crawford and give a little background so people can appreciate
yourself. John Crawford was a young gentleman in his early 20s who, we are an open carry state, so I have to say that, who went into Walmart, found a toy gun laying out, picked it up, and was walking around the store with the toy gun. In a state where you can walk around with a real gun, a person saw him and called the police, called 911, and lied about what he was doing. The police got there and took no time to certify whether, in fact, he was a real danger. And he was actually not around, standing around anyone. He was on the telephone, and they shot him within 2 seconds of seeing him. This is all on video. And so that case, I mean, involves the Walmart in terms of whether or not they were negligent for leaving this toy gun out, involves the guy who called the call in, whether or not he was engaging in an intentional violation of civil rights, involves the Beaver Creek and the police department, like it is in so many places. And it just seems to me like that there is, not just here, but an attempt to set the case up so that they can get the biggest settlement. Now, I'm not surprised by that, because that's what we teach lawyers to do. And justice, this is going back to our very, very discussion. Justice in the terms of a lawyer's eyes is helping an individual client get what the individual client wants. And so to the extent that the individual person wants a settlement, then that's what the lawyer is trained to focus on and only focus on. And they're not trained to try to help their clients to see the social justice ramifications, because they're not trained to look at the social justice ramifications. Lawyers are not trained to look at social justice as an issue at all.
But do black lawyers, considering the shared history that they should be aware of, considering that they too have been subjected to racism, is this something that they need to be taught, that there is a...
I'm afraid they do need to be taught. I teach race and racism in American law, and I still teach it, and I teach... My school is fairly conservative and mostly white, and I don't get many white students in my class because they've labeled me a racist, but that's another story. But last time I taught this class, I had about 6 black students and a couple Asian students and a white student in the class. And I always ask this question. I ask them, what law would you be willing to break and go to jail for because you felt it was unjust? Past, present, or future. Imagine a law that you would say, if they ever passed a law that did X, I wouldn't do it. I would risk going to jail. I have to say that the black students sat there looking at me as stunned as the white students and the Asian students. So they say, well, we're lawyers. And I said, yes, you're lawyers. You're going to be a lawyer in another 3 months. You're getting ready to graduate, because we're talking about third-year students. I said, but are you saying that you would obey any law just because it was a law? Think about your history. Think about, and the black students looked at me blank, like, we don't know what you're talking about. So I had to say, are you saying that if you lived in the 1800s and you was a free man, free person in the North, and a runaway slave came to your door, you turn them in? And then the light bulb goes off and they say, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I hadn't even thought about that. I said, and so it's my inclination that these grandchildren of ours, because that's what I'm talking about, the 21, the 22 through 45, 50-year-olds even, don't connect with that history as much as they should. And so when they get into law school, they get into a historically white law school who teaches them that their main and only responsibility is to protect the system to get what their individual clients want. They go out thinking that. Maybe some lives, you know, I always get a few students. I mean, I think the students who take my class are far ahead of the students who don't. And even they don't have that consciousness. So I think, yeah, I don't think that I would think that black students, because they were black, needed less training.
In fact, this is very clear. I've pointed out that in Ferguson, Missouri, the bulk of what I would consider the grunt work, the legal grunt work, was done not by the lawyers for the family, but by the ACLU of Missouri. And it is painful to see this replicated across the country in these cases where the lawyers may not have had, and it's hard to imagine that the lawyers who are, I peg to be in their 40s and 50s, and with advisors who certainly should have a more palpable connection to the recent past and to the present in terms of racism within the system, that it seems after all of this mobilization and the clear impression on the part of the public that this is a matter of justice and the mobilization behind that, that we still see the lawyers, the African-American lawyers handling these cases, setting that aside, using the momentum of these movements essentially to shore up a fat settlement. And that is considered justice in these cases.
And that is because that's the legal definition of justice. That's the training. And the white, I think you would see the exact same thing in if there was a movement among whites. In fact, I know you do, that what you have is when white victims of police, the lawyers they get look for settlement, look for, when they litigate, let me say this, they may want to litigate, but they're not litigating for the good of the community. They're litigating for the good of that family so that they can get the biggest award possible.
However, I would counter that. I appreciate your point, but the question is, the white person who is a victim of police brutality, number one, it's, I mean, statistically rare. Number two, the African-American, on the other hand, is typical of a class of people who are likely to be subjected to this kind of police brutality and excessive use of force, as has been statistically shown. So I was wondering why any lawyer, white or black, taking on a case with these dimensions that are clearly suggesting that you're dealing with a class action or potential class action here, if the idea is about justice, which is what is publicly professed.
Except you're legally not dealing with a class action. I mean, this is how the system protects itself. There's a whole, the fact that the only people or the majority of people who are getting killed by police are black doesn't make this a class action. The class action is about having a particular company. So if Beaver Creek kills up a lot of people, then all of the families of those people they killed, Beaver Creek killed, could do a class action. But every family all over the United States can't do a class action because they got different people they want to sue. But that's not the issue. To me, the point is that lawyers are trained to not think of justice as what is best for the community, but to think of justice as what is best for the family. And in fact, people will tell you, you know, when I serve the needs of my individual client, then I have contributed to justice in this society. And so the need of their individual client may or may not dictate that they file amicus briefs on issues, that they come out against the prosecutor, that in fact it may be against their interests of their client to do that. It may be better, it may be more in their client interest to keep a low key profile, file your suit, but not to be too vocal about it. I mean, lawyers are trained, and black lawyers who go to historically white institutions, law schools, or HBCUs who operate like historically white institutions, because that's a whole nother issue. Just because it's an HBCU don't mean that they haven't adopted the Eurocentric legal way of training.
An HBCU, by the way, is a historically black college or university.
Exactly. I'm sorry. Historically black college or university. So it doesn't, just because you have a black lawyer, and in fact, I would say that if you want a black lawyer or any lawyer that is going to deal with social justice from a community point of view, you're going to have to do a lot of interviewing and looking. You cannot just assume that the lawyer is going to be able to do that because they haven't been trained. They've been trained to do almost the opposite.
Well, let's take this to the federal level for a moment. The U.S. Attorney General, soon to be retired from his position, Eric Holder, as well as the nominee, are African Americans. And one wonders whether, in your view, the situation of justice has improved under the Obama administration and Eric Holder first. Let's talk about that.
Well, the situation of justice has remained essentially unchanged. Not improved. Justice meaning, okay, let me define justice. Justice meaning an equality of treatment under the law that protects you from racial and systemic and institutional racism. Okay. And the Obama administration hasn't really undertaken to make systemic changes, nor has Eric Holder. They actually just used some of the tools they had, So they found that Cleveland Police Department is in violation of civil rights, okay. But they haven't tried to do massive lawsuits against different police entity, which I think that if they wanted to change the system, what we know is that if you want to change the legal system, you've got to sue. The lack of suits mean that the system is likely not to change. You've got to sue even if you think you're going to lose. So there hasn't been massive lawsuits against different institutions. And in fact, in almost most of the cases, they have said that they haven't found a civil rights violation. I think that they have put a good face on it that may be a little bit different than the Bush, in that they're willing to entertain an investigation, whereas maybe the Bush administration would just say, no, we're not going to investigate it. The Obama administration says, okay, we'll investigate it, but the result is the same. That is, we're not going to do anything about it. We haven't found a violation of civil rights. The Obama administration has executive power that could have made a correction in a lot of things in the legal system by using both the power of the agency power and funding power, and they haven't done that. So, no, I don't think that justice, in terms of the way I've defined justice, I don't think the Obama administration has improved things at all. Hello?
United States Attorney for the Eastern District, Loretta Lynch, is the nominee to replace Eric Holder. What do you see there as the likelihood that what was not accomplished under the Eric Holder might be accomplished under Ms. Lynch?
Well, I think the issue is Ms. Lynch going to be different than her record? Because based on her record, she protects people who is in support of the death penalty, is in support of not legalizing marijuana, not decriminalizing marijuana, is in support of, she is not for, has not expressed ideas that indicate that she's going to advocate for changes in how the Justice Department operate or what it has done. And in fact, I suspect, based on her history of negotiating settlements and plea deals for white-collar criminals, that she's going to be more empathetic to that group than she is going to be to us. She is another one that I think we should not have supported. I was very disappointed when my sorority turned out for her because she was a Delta, because when you look at her record, she doesn't seem like someone that's going to be good for the African-American community.
What would be a person who would be good for the African-American community? What attributes would that position hold?
Well, you see, the problem is anyone that's going to be really good would never rise up high enough to be able to get the position. But I think that they would have demonstrated a willingness. So let's say they were a prosecutor, that when you looked at their record, you would not see racial disparities in their prosecutions. Because you would see that they, while not maybe being able to change the system, had made concerted efforts to change how they operate within the system. That kind of, and that their operations, what they've done, recognizes that the system has a disparate impact on African Americans. And so I think that that's the attributes. I don't know. I think a good attorney, that's all well and good. But I think that there needs to be a commitment shown to social justice in their work. Because anybody who doesn't work, the system is so set up that if you don't work on it, you will look just like everybody else. And so the attribute I would look for is a prosecutor, an assistant attorney general who actually did things different in their little corner of the world.
What does a picture of the work of justice look like to you? I know you are on the organizing end. You have said at the beginning of the program that you are now, as an elder, you're pushing the leadership of the younger ones to the fore and taking basically a backstage position. But is the work of racial justice being approached, in your view, as a scientific endeavor as opposed to spontaneous reaction?
Well, I think that it has in the past been mostly spontaneous reaction. Although there's a lot of people who do, I think, play people like Color Lines and Praxis. There are a number of people who approach the racial justice work in a scientific manner and in an attempt to lay foundations, build upon the foundations, and to be systematic in how they go about making changes and attacks to make changes. So I think there are a number of organizations. I think LDF is doing, under Sherilyn Finn, is trying to do some of that stuff. But I think that there's also the spontaneous, that at the grassroots level, not the professional, because I see Color Lines and Praxis and LDF, those are all professionals in the racial justice arena. Then there's the grassroots organizing. Those are all sort of spontaneous. And frankly, I think they're both are needed. There's a third element that there is no sense. I don't think either one of them places on the system a sense of urgency to change. And without that sense of urgency to change, that the system can respond to them making little small incremental changes without really making large systemic changes. So I think that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 came about after years and years of work, because there was a bit of urgency placed on the United States coming out of World War II and claiming, starting this new human rights organization and wanting to be the face of human rights in the world and having a country in which people were illegally discriminated against. There was an urgency to change that face, and so they did. I don't see that sort of urgency in the racial justice racial justice work now. I don't know how we get it.
But do you see also any evidence of an increased involvement by whites in the matter of racial justice?
I see on my local level, there is an increased involvement of whites than there has been in the last 20 or 30 years. But I've also seen an increased number of whites that don't believe racism is a problem. It's a weird kind of thing that of the whites that believe racism is a problem, I see increased involvement of them. I'm involved in marches around here, and we have quite a few whites that are involved in it. But by the same token, we have, it's a small, they represent a very small percentage of the white population. And based on research, the majority of whites believe that that they're discriminated against more than black people. So we live in a really odd time for racial justice.
So what does the future hold in this arena in which you have now basically found your second wind?
Well, I do the work, to tell you the truth, to be quite frankly, I do the work so that my grandsons can say that their grandmother tried. I do not do the work because I believe that what I do is going to make significant change. I think that we can't lay down and take it. I think we have to work at it. But I don't know. We have a very militaristic corporate capitalist society that is making it harder. I think we have moved into a fascist society, and that the imprisonment of black people is now a profit center, and in a capitalist system, the last thing they will do is get rid of a profit center. So I don't know. I don't want to say I despair because I don't, but I do wonder what will it take to make a significant change, or whether it will always be one of those things where you will work and work and work, and they'll be like, so we have this building up on the police, and at some point they'll make some changes, but they won't basically change the society. But things will cool down because the change will take the pot off the fire for a while. And then as soon as the pot's off, as soon as things cool down, they put the pot back on and things will build up again. I don't know if we're in that kind of system or whether we can really have a revolution and have revolutionary change. And I really think that unless we have revolutionary change, that racial justice is doomed to be a forever problem for black people.
You have to understand that I'm hearing the words revolutionary change coming from a voice that seems very calm and very contained about that. And you're talking about very serious stuff here. Would revolutionary change be the end result of all these years of neglect, of people just getting fed up, of no movement, of no true movement? In the way of progress?
I don't think that the revolutionary change will be able to come around about just because of black people being fed up. I think it's going to have to be coalescing around all of the people who are completely fed up. Asians, Native Americans, Hispanic, Muslims, poor whites, Appalachian whites. I think that there's going to have to be a coalescence around that, and that people are going to have to. I truly believe that until we are willing to risk our lives for change, we are going to have no change. I kind of believe Frederick Douglass in his poem, in his speech, where he says that, that the extent of the oppression that is experienced by a people is only limited by how much we're willing to take. And that is limited by what we're willing to do. And in his poem, he says, and that may be our own lives and it may be the lives of others, but at some point, people are going to have to stop believing that they live in a just system, getting back to the issue of justice, and they have to say the American democracy never existed. American capitalism works only for the top 25%. We don't want either one of these. And go about making a change in how America operates. My problem is I don't see how that can happen if all we rely on is voting, because the voting system is designed to maintain the system. If all we rely on is taking individual cases to court, because the legal system is designed to preserve the status quo. The legal system itself and the operators within the legal system are designed to preserve the status quo. I certainly don't want my children involved in a revolution, but I don't see how change can come to the United States. That or zombie invasion.
A zombie invasion. What do you see yourself doing in the immediate future?
Well, I mean, I'm going to carry on the work from where I am. I believe in working locally. I believe in helping people nationally and internationally. I am going to Geneva in May to talk about how bad the educational system is for black students and how our students are being trained to be prisoners. I was in healthcare up until I retired, and I actually have done little work on healthcare. I've been all involved in education because I really do believe that the United States has established a massive profit center around incarceration, and that they're actually training our children to be prisoners, that the schools are designed to make obedient prisoners. And with the suspensions in preschool, I mean, our kids get we're talking about preschool suspension, kindergarten suspensions, first, second, and third grade suspensions. Then, of course, it just escalates, and then children get to the eighth grade, and they can't read because of they're living in poverty, and our country's hate of the poor is just palpable. So we've got all these children who are growing up in poverty, who are growing up working class, who are not getting the education they need. They're dropping out of schools, they're getting into trouble, and they're going into the prison system.
This is something that we've talked a lot about on this program, this school-to-prison pipeline. I want to thank you so much, Elder Vanellia Randall, for being with us today and coursing us through your thinking on this very important subject of justice and your part in it as well, trying to educate a new breed of lawyer and doing the work where you are. So thank you so much. How can people know more about the Justice Now?
Well, we have a website, Racial Justice Now, and you can go to that. And I also have a website that's been on the internet for 20 years called racism.org. Okay. And that's another place you can go.
Well, thank you again for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. Keep it right here on PRN.FM. Delighted to be with you today. I hope this you enjoyed this program. Let me know at leadstories@gmail.com. And you can also write me at Facebook at Lead Stories with Eutrice Lead. And we'll see each other tomorrow for Free Your Mind Friday. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. Bye-bye.